Some women impersonate Sex and the City's Carrie Bradshaw with vast closets full of fantastic clothing. Even Sarah Jessica Parker pretends to be Carrie Bradshaw when she walks the red carpet. However, there is one woman in New York City who, if he knew her, would have been Darren Star's real muse. Let me introduce you to Susan S. Warner, the adorable petite blonde who at 59 lost her handsome, extraordinary husband to cancer 6 months after her wonderful 32-year-old son died by suicide. It's now 4 years later. After the most challenging days and nights, Susan decided to live her best life possible. And just like that, Susan was suddenly single. Carrie may have Susan beat on exposure, but Susan has Carrie beat on life's experiences. Listen in.
Re-entering the world as a single person after the death of a spouse is definitely a test of resiliency. Everyone reacts differently, and no one should be judged on how they want to conduct their future. It's a very personal decision. I would like to explore with Susan her experiences because what she experienced was very different, and Susan had to overcome two devastating events: the loss of her son 6 months before the death of her husband. No one has to tell Susan how defeated a person can feel and how overwhelming it was to move forward with her life, but she did it. Now I want Susan to share it with you. Let's explore how you jumped into the social world. Although this podcast is about re-entering the social world after widowhood, I'd like to ask you about you and Michael re-entering together after David's suicide. So, Susan, how did the two of you cope with re-entering the social world after David's death?
There are two ways a couple can go after experiencing such a catastrophic loss as the death of a child. You can be split apart, which is very common, or you can find even more love. I'm very proud to say that Michael and my relationship became even deeper and more committed with more love. So we really looked to each other and cocooned each other in this experience. As I've told you before, Lois, I have an exceptionally strong family that is very cocooning and very caring. So my social experience was primarily with my family. There, the heads weren't always cocked. People didn't always look for answers. There was a sadness behind their eyes that I would always see. I do remember Elizabeth, Michael, and I going to dinner in the Hamptons the first time, and we bumped into someone we knew, and they were so flustered and so uncomfortable, we wanted to slide under the table. So it was a matter of getting out there and doing it, and it was not comfortable and it was not easy. So in the beginning, for a while, because Michael died 6 months after David's death, we pretty much stayed within our family limits and alone together and with our daughter, Elizabeth.
How long after the death of your husband, Michael, did you realize you had to or wanted to become social again with the outside world?
I don't think, had I not been pushed over the ledge, I don't know if I would still be out there dating and in relationships. My daughter told me that she was advised that dating on the apps was like a job interview and that I should do that and she should do that. I think the advice was for me. So she advised me what apps to go on after a year. This was a solid year after Michael died, where the idea of attending a celebration, a wedding, a bar mitzvah, a party, made me nauseated. I couldn't go. And I didn't understand that before I experienced these deaths, how people mourned and couldn't go. I could not go. It wasn't in my DNA. So Elizabeth, after over a year, it was April, 13 months after Michael's death, told me what to do. I went home. I set up my profile. I picked some pictures. I clicked and I began that journey of app dating that made me grow up and realize that there's a whole big world out there. I have found in my travels that it appears to me, and I'm not going to generalize, but it appears to me that oftentimes men jump into the dating world faster than women. It's not a gross generalization, but that's been my experience. that they fish around and see what's out there and start looking for companionship earlier. But I think that's based on the dynamic of men having a little bit more difficult time maintaining their households and their lives. Women tend to be, I think, more of the glue and hold homes together. So I can give you my experience as a woman, which I think is somewhat common. As I said, most of the men that I've talked to have jumped in a little earlier.
I hear you, but what were the first steps that you took? Because even though you said it was so difficult, then how did you like manage to do this? It was so overwhelming for you.
Yeah. You know, Madeline of children's literature, bravery, you know, you clench your fists and you put them by your sides and you take a deep breath and you say, if I want to move on, I want to move forward. I've always been a woman who liked being a couple. I got married at 22. I liked being in relationships. I like male attention. I like being around men. So I did realize that there was definitely a void in my life. The first social event I attended, and I've talked about this, is my college roommate's daughter's wedding, where I went with so much trepidation. I can't believe I got there. I did get there on Amtrak. I did seek out some help in things like zipping my dress, which is a chapter in my book, Never mm-hmm. Say Never, Never Say Always. How do you zip your dress when you're alone? And my sister-in-law, Angie, was on the phone with me saying, you know, go to the ceremony, get yourself a glass of wine. It doesn't work. Go back to the hotel and watch Bravo. About 10 minutes into the cocktail hour, as I'm standing there alone, not really knowing anybody, someone yells out, Susie Saul, which was my maiden name and what I was called back in the day. And I turn around and it was my roommate's husband's roommate. And they embraced me and took me under their wing. And I sat at their table and they danced with me and they talked to me and they took up my whole evening. And it was one of the most pleasant evenings I've spent. So all those times that I had that trepidation, I knew it wasn't going to work. It was going to be awful. I was going back to the hotel. It turned out to be an absolutely lovely, lovely evening because two people decided to embrace me with their kindness.
So when you what I'm hearing from you is that even though this was very difficult, once you did it, something great could happen, and that gives you the wind below your sails.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, always when we expect the worst, we're pleasantly surprised, right? We have zero anticipation. We have zero expectation. And then it turns out to be an extraordinary situation. That's how I felt. You know, the man that I had been dating at the time said to me, I'll drive you to Albany. And I said, no, you're not invited. That's not going to work. Very generous offer. And I'll wait for you, you know, but that wasn't going to work. I needed to be at this wedding. I needed to honor my college roommate, Linda and Stephen. And yeah, my huge anticipation and my zero expectation became an extraordinary night. And it really started me on the path of knowing how much kindness is out there from people who aren't necessarily related to me or in my inner circle. People on the periphery of my life have showed me so much kindness and so much consideration. And through that, Lois, I can tell you, and I was just thinking about that this weekend, my world is fortunate that I am the only widow that exists right now in my small piece of the universe. But I do know that when it does happen to a friend of mine, how I will treat them, how sensitive I will be to their needs, how I hope I'm the one there when there are triggers that other people don't realize or that I think could be sensitive, say to them, you good? You okay? Someone did call me after a holiday party I attended this week that was extremely hard for me. It was the company my husband worked with and picked up on the fact that it was a little rough for me. I didn't think I gave that vibe off, but she did pick it up and the next morning said, you good? And that made me feel really good. The fact that someone noticed, the fact that someone cared. So I want to be that person to someone else. And I've received so much love from people and care that are peripheral, that didn't even know they were doing it consciously. And that just gives you faith in human nature that people are good and kind. And that's been my experience for the most part.
Okay. The part that I want to get to is really about once you felt good and you had a great time, what did that do for you and your future? I want people to understand, because you've explained
okay.
it to me so many times.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Firstly, it bolstered my confidence. It made me realize that what I anticipate isn't always what's going to happen. Two, it made me realize I was ready to get out and socialize. that I could make small talk and I could talk about things that weren't catastrophic in my life, and I could be a social animal again. It also taught me that I could be pretty and engaging and interesting. And I had lost a bit of that, I think. And then it bolstered my confidence. And honestly, Lois, that's a reoccurring theme in all of this growth is my first real relationship, although it didn't work and we're dear friends, bolstered my confidence. It helped me be a more interesting person. My current relationship that I'm in has bolstered my confidence and made me feel special and worthy and pretty and smart and funny. And that's what people to people's relationships do. So when you don't go out there and socialize and you do go into your shell and become a bit of an introvert, you don't get the opportunity to grow and grow socially, which is, you know, what puts us at the top of the food chain. So it was confidence. That's the key word here. It gave me the confidence to be a Susan 2.0, a bigger, better me.
Okay, so the question that I think a lot of people would want to know right now from you is, once you experienced the euphoria of life again, you know, how did it feel? I mean, did it awaken you like, oh my God, there's a lot of good to live for yet, and I want to have that experience?
Yes. And I have talked about the fact that couples go through their lives in beautiful relationships, and the relationships morph, and oftentimes the intimacy moves to deep friendships. But when you are widowed or divorced or single, and you decide to embark on a social life, you get to, like, you get a mulligan, you get to do a do-over. And again, I will preface, I take my husband and my son and my whole life back again in a minute, but I can't have it. So I get to find out how another man looks at me, talks to me, touches me, makes love to me. And this is all new. I never thought I'd have that experience again. And I do. And I've learned from every one of those relationships and every one of those encounters. And it's exhilarating in one side and frightening on the other, but it's allowed me to become fuller and more diverse in my being, because I'm seeing how another man reacts and treats me and cares about me. And there's new discoveries I'm making about me and about life and about feelings. So once I dipped the toes in through apps, and I dated, and I got the confidence, and I learned how to make small talk again, and I learned how to push things aside and let things roll off you, and I learned how to judge people maybe a little more keenly for safety, etc. I got the opportunity to be in relationships that have made me better and bigger and more thoughtful. So there is a positive spin to getting out there and being you again, the same you were experimenting with maybe when you were in your 20s or 30s. So it's a silver lining to a very dark place.
So were there specific disappointments and specific pleasant surprises? I know you mentioned some of them, but is there any examples?
Yeah, like the man who, you know, I thought looked like a weasel and was totally disinterested in me and found me unattractive and uninteresting on a date, like that. Or like the man who ghosted me. I didn't like being ghosted. So I think later, through talking to friends, he might have been married and been on the dating app. About failed relationships that are still painful. About rediscovering relationships where you're dating in your 60s is simple. You're not having children together. If you don't have financial dependency on each other, that's simple, but really complicated emotionally. You've got families and set ways and experiences that formed who you are, and now you're trying to forge a road with another person. So in its simplicity is a huge complication. So there's just so much out there to grab and so much to think about, but there's so much depth and richness in going out there and rediscovering a social life.
You have mentioned...
So disappointments I've explained to you. I guess that's the pleasantries as well as the growth.
No, that's perfect. I think there's a lot of emotion there to think about. You have mentioned that you're in a relationship now, but do you sometimes still attend events alone?
I'm glad you asked me that because yes. So sometimes I get invitations to Mrs. Susan Warner and guests. Sometimes I get invitations to Mrs. Susan Warner plus one. And sometimes I get invitations to Mrs. Susan Warner. And that becomes a conundrum. Recently, I had a wedding on Saturday with my companion. And Sunday, I was invited to a wedding, a very large wedding, alone. And it was a student of mine that I felt very strongly and the family that I wanted to attend. So I wrote back, I would love to attend the ceremony, but I will not be joining you for the rest of the evening. Or I'd love to see you married, but, you know, that's it. A little bit more eloquently than that in my response card. And that's what I did. It's really funny. It was marathon day. I had to take a subway down to Cipriani on 42nd Street, and it was massively busy in New York, and I was wearing a cocktail dress, and I felt a little uncomfortable on the subway. I get on the S train crossing over from Grand Central, from Times Square to Grand Central, and I see other people on the train dressed up, man in a bow tie, et cetera, and I tapped on their shoulder. I said, are you going to the Cat's wedding? And they said, yes. I said, I'm going alone. Can I stay with you? And they ushered me through the train situation to Brianna. So I think I've gotten gutsier, and people are so kind. Like they like literally took my hand. Because everybody, I think most people are generous of spirit if you let them be, and you know, that old, you get what you give. And they were so wonderful. And then I sat down at the wedding by myself on the aisle, watched the wedding, and left afterwards. So I've learned to not necessarily do what I think is the right thing, but do what's the right thing for me. And that means attending things alone. And sometimes it's a little hairy. I've gotten better at it. But thank goodness for iPhones, because when you're uncomfortable, you can always look at your phone. That helps.
Right. Would you ever have sent back an RSVP card that said, you know, thank you for inviting me, but I really don't want to attend alone. Can I bring someone?
No, that's not who I am. I feel that after giving a wedding, people have restrictions that, you know, they may not want a stranger. They may not want to pay for a stranger. They may not have known I was with anyone, quite frankly. So it might have been appropriate. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of my friends joked and said, you know, just go as a couple, because if you're just going to the wedding, they won't, what's the difference? But I have to be me. And that's really important to who I am, is that I was invited alone. I'm going to go and do this. I'm going to do what I need to do because I can, and I know how to handle it, and I know how to make it the best situation for me. And you know what? I feel so accomplished afterwards, and I'm so proud of myself. You know, I can be as proud of attending that or putting a chair together or, you know, gardening as I can writing a chapter in the book or having an essay for publication. These mm-hmm. things empower me. They do empower me. So when someone invites me that way, I will not ask for a plus one.
Mm-hmm.
Not
okay. I think that's a great explanation, and it says a lot to a lot of people. I think that's great. What did you do to make sure that you stayed socially connected to the outside world?
As I mentioned, my dear friends and my family would invite me for dinner, would make sure that I was included. It's funny, there's also a time when you were a couple and you socialized with couples that you're in a social situation and realize that you don't fit in anymore. Mm-hmm. And the day in your life when you realize where you do fit in, what makes you comfortable, where it works, is transformational. And it took some trial and error, and it took on their part as well as mine. You know, do we invite her to a dinner party solo, or is this just not a place she belongs? And I understand that. So there was a lot of trial and error in the beginning. I did go to dinner with friends who accepted me singularly, and there were a lot that did, and they're wonderful, and they still do. And I was very protected by my family. You know, I told you I have brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law, 10. We're very strong, you know, we're a mighty unit. So they were very protective and social with me. So that helped enormously. And I know everybody doesn't have that, and I appreciate that. And that is a real gift for me and maybe makes me a little bit of a unicorn. But it really helped. But I will say, even holidays and gatherings, I had to learn what made me comfortable, you know, how much time there made me comfortable, how immersive I wanted to be. You know, one of my family members was so kind to ask Elizabeth and I to spend Mother's Day with them. And it ended up for me being an emotional disaster. I learned. I never would have thought that.
Why?
Because Mother's Day should be spent with my daughter and I and myself being us, not watching someone else celebrate Mother's Day when you've lost a child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was huge. It was a huge revelation. And again, mm-hmm. I've learned, you know, I'm not going to go somewhere for Yom Kippur, which is a very solemn holiday, when I want to be in the environment of my synagogue that totally envelops me and where I feel the most comfortable. So I've learned the rituals and the practices that make me feel the most comfortable, trying to never hurt anyone or be insensitive, but self-preservation, taking care of me, and in turn, Elizabeth as well, if I can.
That's important information for everyone to hear.
Self-preservation is key.
Yeah.
It's key. As long as you're not hurting anyone, you need to do what's right for you, not what you perceive is right. And that's where I got really confused. I was that person that always needed to do the right thing. Not anymore. The right thing could be painful to me or detrimental. You know, if I don't go to a wedding or a celebration because I can't, because it's painful or something's wrong, I shouldn't be so egotistical to think that they're going to miss me. Or
right.
that my presence is going to make a difference. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
So doing what's best for me is definitely the overall prescription.
So Susan, you know, I'm very curious with everything that you've just said. How long did it take you to really feel whole again? And when I say whole again, I mean you're not on the outside looking in. You're inside.
Am I whole again, Lois? I think entering my first relationship and then my second relationship did that. I think that it made me face issues of comparison and love and giving that I was avoiding because I didn't have to do that on a date and I didn't have to do that with my family. That was a given. You know, I gave that anyway. So I think entering relationships has definitely made me grow. Because I was forced to face my demons.
Okay.
You want more?
No, I don't think you, I'm not going to say it right in the podcast. I don't think you really answered my question. I think that when I asked you to be, when you whole again, when you felt comfortable, you did not like analyze every move, you were in the thick mm-hmm. of things. You were happy all the time, you know, doing the functions, you look forward to great things. You know, there's times in everyone's life, whether they're single, you know, or married or widowed or, you know, whatever, divorced. It's like there are periods of time in everyone's life where we're kind of like on the outside looking in
yeah.
for whatever reason. You know, do you today feel like you are whole? Inside, you're making the news. You're not worried about all the things you worried about at the beginning. You are living a full life.
Okay, yes. Yes, I do feel I'm living a full life. Yes, I do feel like I'm making the news. Yes, yes. But let me go back and qualify. The loss of a child is a hole in your heart that never mends. It's a piece of you, an appendage was taken off, and it's never coming back. When you lose a spouse, you, and I'm not going to say you replace them, but you go into relationships that are replacements. You know, you find companionship, love, etc. With a child, never. You know, someone made a very insightful comment to me recently that there's a name for people who lose spouses. They're called widows and widowers. There's no name for a parent that loses a child. I don't think our language could develop is deep enough or hurtful enough or understand the pain enough to develop that name. So I went to a wedding a couple weeks ago where I was so honored by the friend of David's that asked me to sign his marriage license as his witness in David's honor. It was one of the greatest showing of kindness I've ever experienced. His mom, who's a really good friend of mine, Jill, said to me, I know this must be painful for you. And I turned around with total honesty and said, I'm not in pain. I'm loving this joy. So I think that was a turning point for me. And that was a couple weeks ago. And that's 5 years after David's death, that I was all full of the joy for Michael and for Jill and Mark, the parents. And I did not feel sorry for me. So five years. And I meant it. I felt full and happy. And I mean, did I have a tear? Yeah, but I had a tear because I love Michael. I helped raise him. I was, he was my son's best friend. Mm-hmm. So that was 5 years, and I felt, and it came right out of my mouth. I didn't have to think about it. No, it's not pain I feel joy for you and for Michael and for us.
That was a very giving statement.
Yeah, but how they honored me and loved me in this experience was, beyond most anything I've ever experienced. So that was with David. With Michael, I go to events and I go to social events, and I still feel that everyone's looking at me, that it's not Michael and Susan. I do. I'm being honest. I still feel that everyone's looking like, wow, who's this new man with Susan? Mm-hmm. It's not so new. We've been together for a year and a half now. We're definitely a committed couple. And yet I feel it. And I know it's my perception. Is it real? I don't know. Or, Susan looks good with him, or Susan doesn't look good with him, or they make a pretty couple, or they don't. Whatever it is, I'm hearing it in my head. So that's why I questioned, will I ever be 100% secure? I don't know. But I know I'm happy, and I know this is working for me, and I think it's working for him. So we're in a good place.
That was very
Is that more honest?
Yes. And I needed that explanation because I know people out there are going to feel that, because I felt it in my life in many different situations.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to dig deeper to hear what you said, and you were very honest. So, so while you're feeling good all the time, there's still, it could pop up every once in a while.
Yep. Rear its ugly head. Yeah. Yes.
Yep. So my next question was going to be, do you ever slip back and just feel sorry for yourself?
Yes. 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 I'm a happy person. I'm happy when I get up in the morning and when I go to sleep at night, for the most part. I've often said I'm good 360 days a year, and 5 days I am a mess. But yeah, there are times that I want to be Susan and Michael again. I want him back. I want David back. I want to hear, hi, Bear, how are you this morning? That's what he used to call me. I was his bear. Yeah, I feel sorry for myself sometimes. Don't we all, for whatever our losses are or for whatever our regrets are, don't we all feel sorry for ourselves sometimes? I'm as human as anybody else. And yes, my daughter is going to have a baby, and I want Michael to share this with me. And in my heart and in my spirit, he is. But I want him physically here with me. I want him to hold his grandchild. So yeah, I feel sorry for myself sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
That's life. We all do. I don't think my experience makes it more exceptional than anybody else.
I have to ask you this question after you just said that. What do you say to people that just can't get over it and just can't move forward and just want to feel defeated all the time?
I can't tell anybody that their feelings are not justified. Everybody lives in their own head. If they asked me my opinion of how do I get out of this, I think they would have to tell them that they've chosen to live. And then if you've chosen to live your best life. That there's so much out there for you. As I said earlier, find out how someone else talks to you, touches you, loves you, cares for you, makes love to you. It's different. It's exciting. It's exhilarating. Give it a shot. If you don't like it, pull back. But give it your best shot. It's like not tasting all the food on the table because I might not like it, but you might love it. So life's always worth going for the gusto. It's always worth a try. You can always pull back. It's like when you exercise and you put up the tension on your bike when you're spinning. You can always push the tension back. But mm-hmm. give it everything you've got first. You can always recede.
Susan, not everyone out there that's listening to this necessarily, has someone that could touch, feel, and love them. What could you say to those people that are still very much alone, may end up alone? You know, how do they not feel defeated all the time?
You know? Try. Just try. You give what you get. Smile at people. Say good morning. Talk to the person online with you at the store. Go on social media apps. Go date. Talk. You know, you go on the app. You don't have to set up a date on the first one. You usually text and then you FaceTime, and there's a whole ritual dance of how you go about this. Give it a shot. You know, there's a lid for every pot. There is. And there's so many dating apps out there that have different specifications. From
let's put dating aside. Somebody is, you know, married and they lose a child and they just can't move forward. They're just completely defeated. This was, you know, they blame themselves or whatever it is. What can you offer them as a suggestion to, you know, to smile again in their life?
Okay, first of all, Lois, as I always offer this disclaimer, I am not a therapist, and
right.
I can only tell you what's worked for me.
That's what we want to hear.
Right. But in this case, if someone really feels that way and has that depth of feeling, I strongly suggest they talk to somebody. Talking to a therapist, talking to someone is very beneficial for most people. And they will bring up things and enlighten you to ideas that you may not have in your toolkit. They have a whole different toolkit. They're professionals. So anybody who is at the depth that they can't get past how they feel, I suggest talk to someone professionally. And then, you know, I'm a firm believer in the mental mechanisms. Walk it out, talk it out, think it out. You know, go get those endorphins going, go exercise, go to classes, go to the JCC, go to the Y, go places. There's bereavement groups, there's divorce groups. Put yourself out there. If you don't want to do that and you don't want to be social and you like the way the pain feels, and some people do, then feel it. That's your prerogative. It's not the way I choose to live. So I can only tell you what works for me. Getting out there, you know, giving what you get, smiling, being a part of the big, bold world, making conversation, going to a movie by yourself and talking to someone. You know, I do all that. Getting on the dating apps, you know, I think that it works. But if you choose to stay in that dark place because it feels good to you, I can't comment and I can't tell you to change. But I can tell you that it feels a lot better to smile than it does to cry. It's actually easier to smile if you let yourself.
Well, I think that that was remarkable. And I thank you for your words. And I think that this podcast is going to help a lot of people. It will make them think, I think, a lot deeper and give themselves alternatives that they never thought that they could have before.
Challenging yourself can be really, when you challenge yourself, it can be really, really rewarding. And that's my comment, that putting together a chair or setting up a Nest camera is as important as getting published. It feels good. If you're in this place, let's do things that feel good. Usually works out.
Thank you very, very much. And we'll see you. This is podcast number 18. We'll see you at podcast number 19. Thank you.
Thanks, folks.